This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by a brand new all-natural daily preventative against a host of possible inflammatory issues. Black for Health liquid extract from Future Farm Botanicals. Black for Health combines four plant-based foods, black garlic, black radish root, black cumin seed, and black peppercorn, containing high levels of body-ready healing botanicals. It's a tasty supplement with liposome complex for optimal absorption. For more information or to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's myfuture, P-H-A-R-M. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman, and from now until September 15th, buy one bottle of Black for Health and get one bottle of Elderberry with Zinc and Echinacea, half off, at MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. I must confess, I'm very much looking forward to today's conversation because today we're going to find out about why you eat what you eat. That's the title of a book that we're going to discuss. It's The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. And know that this isn't a diet book, although there are really profound implications for dieting in this book, because we're going to be talking to a PhD neuroscientist who has spent a lot of years studying our sense of taste and our sense of smell and the hormones that regulate our appetite and how we form our food preferences and what some of the implications are in terms of practical strategies for managing our food intake. She's Dr. Rachel Hertz. She teaches at Brown University and Boston College. And she is the author of a couple of really great books, and I recall, I think, interviewing her for her first book way back when. It's The Scent of Desire, and it's about pheromones and how we attract or repel people, and also a book called That's Disgusting, and it has to do with what it is that disgusts us, and that's a very interesting science and physiology. And so without further ado, here's Dr. Hertz. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. It's great to be on.
Yeah, it's really a fantastic book, and there's just so much information packed into it. So we're just going to provide people with a bit of a tease. But in the book, she explains how taste and our emotions are intertwined, why eating sweets can make us kinder. Well, that's interesting. How depression can make grapes taste more sour. How bitterness can change our moral outlook. Whoa, you know, I didn't know that tasting food could affect us in so many ways. And also, you know, what motivates us to go for those seconds and thirds? I know my trigger food is pasta. And also, you know, how do we formulate a strategy for curbing our food intake, given that food is ubiquitous and it's appealing? And the food industry uses all kinds of tricks to entice us. That's what we're going to tackle in this discussion. So, well, first of all, you refer to something called neurogastronomy. Wow, you've coined a phrase there. What's that about?
So I didn't coin the phrase. Gordon Shepherd from Yale University about 11 years ago wrote about neurogastronomy in a paper to Nature. And ever since then, the word has been around and more people are starting to use it. And basically, it refers to the interplay between our senses and our psychology and our experience of food and our eating patterns and so forth. So it's our environment on the outside, it's how we feel on the inside, and the brain mechanisms and the senses that are involved in that, and then the outcome, how we approach food, how we digest food even, what happens to our metabolism. So it's basically the topics that I cover in my book.
Okay, so let's start by breaking down the basic tastes, and they are classically sweet, salty, sour, and bitter. And you go into a dissertation about each of them and about how they influence us. And let's start with sweet, because that's such a compelling taste, and it drives so many of us. Talk to us about that.
Well, first of all, I want to say excellent on your part for calling the taste taste, because just as a little aside, people often say the word taste when really what they mean is flavor. So, for example, when we talk about bacon and the taste of bacon, we're not really talking about how salty it is, although that might be something we're commenting on. We're talking about the combination of aroma of bacon plus that salty taste. And that's what flavor is, but most people actually use the word taste.
In your book, I learned that there's in your book, I learned that there are bacon-scented candles, but also that there's bacon-scented underwear. I didn't know that, and I'm not sure who that would appeal to, but.
Well, the funny thing is, so bacon seems to be the most popular aroma and probably food these days in North America in any case, and also a lot of places in Europe. And therefore, you can get anything to assuage your desire for bacon, even the non-edible versions of it. So everything from cologne to candles to underwear and everything in between is really kind of crazy.
Okay. Well, you know what I noticed about sweet, by the way, is, and I reflected on it as I read your account of it, is, you know, when I work out, you know, and sometimes I'm really, you know, going to the red zone in terms of my endurance, I'll reach for my water bottle on my bike, and even though I sometimes put something in there that's sweetened with stevia, just taking a swig of that just kind of, I don't know, makes me power through the pain of climbing a hill or doing an interval, and you comment on that in your discussion.
Yeah, so sorry to have that segue with taste and flavor, but just to get back to sweet in general. So sweet, we are hardwired to love the taste of sweet. And that's because sweet is an indicator for carbohydrates. So everything that is to say, so you eat bread, that's carbohydrates, but it breaks down into simple sugars. The taste of sweet, so from cupcakes to donuts to bread and everything like that, is full of carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are an easy form of energy. That is to say, they're very quickly turned into energy that we can use. Mm-hmm. And crucially, from the point of view of our survival, we need to find fast forms of energy in order to keep going.
Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, that prehistoric man who first scaled a 200-foot cliff and fended off bee stings to attack that hive, that beehive, to just get a taste of honey, pretty powerfully motivated, right?
Exactly. Extremely powerfully motivated. And we have to, unfortunately, deal with that in our current living situation of abundance when we really are not struggling for the most part to survive from a calorie perspective, although we may be struggling from a nutritional perspective. But your comment about stevia is really interesting, because stevia is a non-nutritive sweetener. Mm-hmm. That's right. It doesn't have calories. Correct? Yeah. And so these days there are a variety of these non-nutritive sweeteners that still taste really sweet. And so they give us, in that moment of tasting them, this real hit of the pleasure that any sweetness will give us. And that feeling of pleasure that you get from pure sweetness is highly motivating. So, and actually, it also helps to diminish pain. So one of the things that's often done, I mean, the idea of giving a little kid a lollipop when you give them an injection when they go to the doctor to get their shots and so forth, that's not just kind of, you know, silly motivation, let's try to get the kid in here and stop him from screaming. It's actually because sweetness reduces the sensation of pain. Not enormously, but to a certain extent, and to a palpable extent. And so using sugar as a way to bring pain down, it's actually also why in the Jewish ceremony of a bris, the circumcision ceremony, the infant is given either a little dab of sweet wine or sugar water because of the fact that, you know, if that taste on the tongue is going to be soothing, it's actually going to relieve pain. And so in your case of really pushing yourself from a physical perspective and feeling pain, you know, the extreme, you know, athletic activity can actually be really painful, you're giving yourself this mental hit where your brain is actually responding to the positive sensation of the sweetness and helping you get through it.
And it's not even a question of hydration, you know, because, yeah, I mean, you do get a little bit of liquid, but it's more about the taste, and water doesn't do the trick quite as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, though, that can happen with non-nutritive sweeteners is your body can get wise to you after a while and realize that, you know, I'm not actually getting any calories here, so the effect might diminish, but if you just take little sips here and there, you're probably still going to get the positive feeling of that sweetness on your tongue, which is in itself still highly pleasurable.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to salty, it actually has something to do also with neurotransmitters in the brain. Salt, and there's something also related to, there's a male-female dichotomy in terms of salt preference, it seems.
I actually don't think that's correct.
Was it sour or bitter? Bitter, I think, is about...
Not bitter. There's actually a difference in terms of spicy preference.
Okay, right.
So maybe we're talking about the taste of, like, when you have hot peppers in your... Like, the desire for really hot peppers, people who really like hot peppers. There's a connection to testosterone levels.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you want to talk about that or if you want to talk about salty or...
We can have, as usual, we devolve into sort of a free association here. So, you know, let's talk, you know, why the appeal of spicy peppers? I mean, they hurt, and then people enter these contests to see, you know, how many BTUs they can actually tolerate. You know, what's that about?
Okay, sorry, I don't mean to correct you, but it's a Scoville scale.
Okay.
It's SKU.
Right. I'm thinking SKU. Heat
it's,
units. Yeah,
it's sort of. Yeah, you're thinking of the bitter units, but it's. What is the Scoville scale? But it's like either, I'm getting confused with SKU, which is SKU, and it's not quite that. Now I'm blanking on what it is, but it's the Scoville scale. So it's how many units on the Scoville scale you can withstand. And yes, so the interesting thing about desire for hot peppers is it falls under a category of behaviors that are referred to as benign masochism. That is to say that you're doing something to yourself that's painful. You're willfully doing it. So you've gone out and you've put an effort into doing something that's actually at one level unpleasant, but you're deriving pleasure from it, and you also know that it's not really hurting you.
Mm-hmm.
So that is to say, you can eat hot peppers, and there is potentially some transient effect of some, let's say, burning in the mouth, and potentially also, especially if you have something like stomach ulcers, you don't want to be doing this because it can cause gastric upset. But apart from that, you're not actually hurting yourself physiologically, and yet you are producing this extreme sensation.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that the desire for doing this is correlated with the sort of personality trait of sensation seeking,
mm-hmm.
as is the desire to ride roller coasters and
like dopamine junkies
movies.
Or, you know, people who are trying to stoke their dopamine receptors, maybe.
Yes, exactly. And the other thing is that it's correlated with testosterone levels.
Mm-hmm.
So it is the case that males tend to be more of the types that would enter these habanero eating contests than females do. But not to say that there aren't women who also enter these contests, but it is predominantly male because the higher testosterone level, the more sort of this drive for mouse power, whatever you might want to call it,
it might have been
be. And therefore,
the origin of the expression, that'll put hair on your chest, you know, to like
yeah,
five alarm chili, you know. And so maybe, you know, intuitively, you know, in these ancient expressions actually have some basis in neurophysiology. Very interesting.
Right, but the other thing that's really great about these experiences that are painful but not extremely, you know, that are not dangerous, is they actually also release endorphins. The feeling of experiencing pain is actually quelled by the fact that your body is producing its own version of morphine in order to combat that sensation, which in and of itself is a high. So people like chili heads talk about getting a high from this, and they're actually truly experiencing a high from their body's own production of endorphins.
Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors to share this important message with you. Here goes. Naturally occurring black pigments in vegetables, spices, and seeds have been found to have powerful anti-inflammatory effects. Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I'm excited about what I think may be the next big thing in anti-inflammatory supplements, a brand new, all-natural, daily preventative against a host of possible inflammatory issues. Black for Health liquid extract from Future Farm Botanicals. Black for Health combines four plant-based foods, black garlic, black radish root, black cumin seed, and black peppercorn, containing high levels of body-ready healing botanicals. It's a tasty supplement with liposome complex for optimal absorption. For more information, order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's myfuturefarm, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman, and from now until September 15th, buy one bottle of Black for Health. You get one bottle of elderberry with zinc and echinacea half off at myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you. And now back to our guest, Dr. Rachel Hertz. So sour and bitter, I learned this from reading this, is that they're sort of the opposites on the pH spectrum, sour being acidic and bitter being alkaline, correct?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was that chemically simple. Sour tastes are appealing.
So sour tastes are acids. So like we can think about citrus fruits, for example, and let's say take a lemon, which is classically, you know, the sour citrus fruit. And I bet you right now you and probably your listeners are starting to salivate when I'm talking about sour lemons.
Okay. Yeah.
Because that's actually, you know, such an experience that happens to us when we eat sour foods. We do produce more saliva in our mouth, and just thinking about sour can actually produce like conditioned response of salivation. And so the fact that acids are sour is something that we are drawn to a certain extent. It's also, you know, good information, because from the point of view of fruit, the less acid is in it, usually the more ripe it is and the sweeter it tastes. So if we're trying to distinguish between foods, the more you like sour foods, and there's definitely cultural differences in cuisine. So for example, in Asian cuisine, especially Korean as one example, there's a lot more sour profile to the food that one eats, and therefore there's a lot more sort of liking of sour. Whereas, for example, in sort of the average North American diet, where there isn't a lot of sour, except for maybe kind of in the condiment level, then people tend to not like sours as much. But kids also really like sour. So those Warhead candies, which are extremely, extremely sour, there's a desire for intense sour taste amongst kids too, which is quite interesting.
I think a more consequential taste is bitter. And from what I understand, people have different tolerances for bitter. There are super tasters. There's also a variation in one's susceptibility to bitter tastes based on whether a woman is pregnant, for example, they have less of a tolerance for bitter. Young kids may have less of a tolerance for bitter than adults. What about that?
So just like we're programmed to love the taste of sweet because it means energy and calories, we are also programmed to not like the taste of bitter, because although there are some exceptions to the rule, like some healthy leafy greens and things like kale and endive, generally speaking in nature, bitter is poison.
Mm-hmm.
And so
poisonous alkaloids, they're alkaline compounds that are natural poisons.
Right. And so, for example, that little red berry that you might taste that looks so pretty, it's going to taste bitter if it's a poisonous one. And that means get it out of your mouth. And so we are actually, the expression that you make when you taste something bitter is both the sort of bleh, get it out, and also the pursing of the mouth, don't let any more of that in. So we're protecting ourselves even with that facial expression. And yes, even though everybody does not like bitter, there are degrees to which we are sensitive to bitter. And your point about this differentiation in terms of taster status, and so people more or less in thirds fall into either being super tasters, tasters, or non-tasters, and this is genetically determined. This doesn't have anything to do with past experiences. So you're either born with the genes that represent being a super taster, you have a mix of the two types of alleles, and you're a taster, or you have the two versions, which mean you're a non-taster. And what this correlates to actually is the number of taste buds on your tongue. So super tasters taste bitter as much more intense and extreme, but they also taste sweet and sour and creamy and tingly, you know, spicy. So everything is more intense in the mouth of a super taster. And so this can go also, there's been some personality factors which have been found to be correlated with whether or not you're a super taster. Generally speaking, super tasters are also more sensitive to emotion, especially negative emotion. And so
disgust or, which is actually a theme of one of your books.
Right. And also even anger and sadness. So it's like these feelings that are negative but are also protective, because being hyper aware of bitter, although sometimes can lead you astray, like with the healthy leafy greens, is generally protective from the point of view of keeping you alive, because you don't want to eat bitter. And your comment about pregnant women is really interesting, because when you're pregnant, you are not only in charge of your own health, but you're also in charge of the health of the developing fetus inside of you. And to be extra careful about consuming anything that might be poison or off or, you know, not fresh or spoiled or somehow can make you sick, having that sort of heightened taste sensitivity to protect you from that is really important. And that's why women during pregnancy, especially earlier stages of pregnancy, when it's most important not to consume anything dangerous, tend to have a heightened perception of bitter.
But you also know there can be some negative consequences of being a super taster, because we get all these beneficial polyphenols from fruits and vegetables, some of which are bitter. And if you don't tolerate those, you don't eat your veggies, your green leafies, and you might be at higher risk of certain cancers, but also you might be at higher risk of gaining weight.
So actually, super tasters tend to be on average of lower BMI than non-tasters.
Okay,
so they actually don't have as much risk of gaining weight, because basically everything is more intense. So if you were a super taster, then the creaminess of that caramel or that ice cream would be quite strong, and you would probably not need as much to feel satiated and satisfied and happy with what you're eating. Whereas mm-hmm. if you're not getting as much intensity from that creamy caramel or ice cream, you might want to eat more. So on average, and this is definitely on average, the BMI of super tasters is somewhat lower than that of non-tasters. But you're absolutely right when it comes to the certain forms of cancer. It's been seen because super tasters are avoiding the taste of bitter, they're also avoiding these healthy foods which have the polyphenols and the antioxidants that can be protective against cancers, and so they run that risk. Interestingly, though, super tasters tend to like salt. It's the one taste they like more of than non-tasters, and that's because it's actually the case using salt blocks bitter. So if you were trying to force down some Brussels sprouts, and you put some salt on them, they would taste less bitter. So super tasters like more salt, and they use more salt than non-tasters.
Interesting. Also, there's this phenomenon called pica, and based on the notion that you sometimes crave what you need, and it's actually thought to be the basis for why a lot of these kids in the inner city developed lead toxicity, because they were maybe malnourished, they didn't get enough calcium, so they picked up paint chips and chewed on them. I mean, why would you pick up paint chips and chew on them? But it seems to be sort of an innate behavior when you're seeking minerals.
Yes, that's right. So there's been, you know, this theory that we sort of have these quote-unquote specific hungers, which is when we're deprived of a macronutrient or something like a mineral or other kind of chemical that we need physiologically, we'll seek it out and in places that also aren't necessarily food. So eating chalk, eating paint, even though in this case it also contains lead, which is quite dangerous, was a way, it seemed, that was helping these kids and also other people who display this behavior, trying to build up the reserves of the nutrient that they were missing. And you'll also sometimes see this with salt. So one of the reasons why, for instance, if you're working out a lot on and very hot weather, you need salt, and potentially you can also end up craving more salt because of the dehydration you're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why I'm such a pickle fancier. That could be it. We're also, in addition to being programmed to love sweets, we're also programmed to love fat. So, you know, I guess the ideal concoction is something that's very sweet and very fat. So that would be like, what, premium ice cream?
Yes, you know, ice cream, donuts, you know, luscious chocolate, things like that. Mm-hmm. These are the kinds of things that we really love. And this is, I mean, and actually you can have kind of savory versions of this, because it doesn't have to necessarily be super sweet. So you can have all different kinds of fried things that are potentially on the savory side. So even chips, which are salty, also have a high carbohydrate, and they're also highly fat. So, you know, we love the sensations of sweet and carbohydrate and fat, and they are both, they're very pleasurable for our brain. So, for example, you know, sweet triggers the reward system of our brain. It releases dopamine. We can also have from carbohydrates, we can have an increase in serotonin production, which is like the feel-good neurotransmitter. That's what your antidepressants are trying to elevate. And in terms of fat, fats also release endorphins. As I also mentioned, so does sweetness. And so if you're feeling down, literally, you know, the pain psychologically can be relieved by consuming, you know, donuts, at least very temporarily.
Right.
And
comfort
the problem
food, yeah.
is, though, that they're not good for you. So, you know, in the long run, this doesn't help whatever you're going through. But in the short term, they can feel really good.
Well, sometimes understanding is a pathway to getting on top of some of our impulses and controlling them. That's going to be the theme in part two. We divide our podcast into two parts, so stay tuned. But we're going to talk about some of the implications of this neurogastronomy. Why You Eat What You Eat is the title of a new book by today's guest, Dr. Rachel Hertz. It's the science behind our relationship with food, and there's some important take-home messages for us as we try to manage our cravings and appetites in this toxic food environment. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.